Big thanks to Stackery for supporting this episode. Stackery is the global leader in international parcel forwarding from the United States. Shop at any US retailer and ship anywhere, including Europe, with Stackery.com at prices up to 80% less than directly from the store. Stackery provides free storage, same-day consolidation of your packages, and a tax-free US address. Save 10% off your first shipment with the coupon Europeans. Find the link in our show notes. Stackery is spelled Stackery.com.
Hello and welcome to The Europeans, the podcast about all your favourite European stuff. Decent public services, weird cheeses, bad weather, rising nationalism. I'm Katie Lee, I'm a journalist in Paris, where I'm finally home after a delightful and unexpected overnight stay in Warsaw Airport. And I'm joined on Skype, as always, by Mr. Munich, opera singer extraordinaire, Dominic Graymer. Are you there, Dominic?
I am there, but it's not as always in Munich. I mean, I live in Amsterdam.
Feels like always at the moment.
That's true.
Jeez, I've been there forever.
It might be the final episode coming from Munich, depending on when we decide to record next week. Sad tears.
Are you going home finally?
Sad tears is not a thing people say.
No, but I know what you meant, because we are millennials.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm going home next, a week today, in fact, and the show opens this Tuesday, so please all do whatever your local European tradition is for sending good luck to podcasters in need.
Oh, that's a good mini feature we should do, like what things people around Europe pat for good luck or cross or whatever.
Yeah, like hanging a horseshoe on the door. I think they do that in Germany, don't they?
Don't they do that in England?
Oh, maybe that's just a Christian thing generally.
Why would horseshoes be Christian, though?
I don't know, but we'll please everyone put us right, because we shouldn't talk anymore about things that we know nothing about. But how was it in Slovenia?
It was great, yeah. Until my mini accidental Polish holiday, I was having an amazing week. You might have seen my many, many smug photos on Instagram. What a country. I think it's my new favourite country in the entire world. It looks a lot like, you know, in Studio Ghibli films. Have you seen any Studio Ghibli films?
Yes, I have. With your boyfriend, in fact. I went to see The Red Turtle.
He's a big fan. You know how in those films, Europe always looks really nice and it's full of like little alpine cottages and meadows and everyone's always like smiling and baking bread?
That's Slovenia, is it?
That is Slovenia. I mean, I'm sure it's a country that has its problems and is very complex, as all countries are. But anyway, everything I saw of it was just perfect lakes and meadows and little huts, and we went paddling and ate good things. It was so nice. And then I booked a flight home via Poland because it was way cheaper and I'm a massive cheapskate. And next thing I know, there's this big thunderstorm and I've missed my connecting flight. So I'm stuck in Warsaw Airport for the night. So it's kind of exciting. Like, they give you all these vouchers to spend on stuff.
And also, aren't you going to get 300 euros compensation because of the EU law about like a delay? Oh no, it's because of weather. You don't get it when it's because of weather.
I don't think I get anything. But I did get 40 zlotys to spend on my dinner, which was great. And then I slept in the airport hotel, which was actually really nice because the extraordinarily friendly receptionist, because I had to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning for the flight, he made me a little breakfast in a bag. And then he packed me off with this cheery, "Next time you come to Warsaw Airport Hotel, I hope it's by choice."
Oh, sweet.
So I was like, yes, that will definitely be happening.
But I want to know more about Slovenia. So you left on the day of the election, didn't you?
No, isn't it the day of the election today?
Oh, so you didn't.
No.
You left the day before the election. But it looks like the populists are doing really well. Yay.
Yay. I'm spotting a trend here.
Funny that.
I couldn't really understand the posters. My Slovenian is not great. But I did hear that there were lots of sort of strong anti-migrant vein running through the election, which again is something that we've heard before.
Yeah, there's a candidate that's backed by Viktor Orban, the Hungarian populist leader, I think.
Yeah.
Looks like they've come top of the polls, but might have difficulty forming a coalition. So, I mean, maybe we'll talk about that next week. Who knows?
But anyway, what happened here? Because I feel like I went on holiday for a week and left you in charge of Europe. And next thing I know, there are new governments in Spain and Italy and reports that a bunch of animals have escaped from a German zoo. Like, what happened?
Very dramatic. Well, not that many animals escaped from a German zoo, it turned out. Like, most of them were actually just hiding.
I love that.
They were just like, ooh, Let's make them think that we've run away.
Just a bear in the end.
Anyway, yeah, so there's been a lot of choice for Good Week, Bad Week this week, hasn't there? Oh, but what's coming up in the podcast?
Hold your horses. We've only got one guest for you this week, but he is extra important. He's the first guest we've ever had on the show that we've had to call Mr. Ambassador. It felt a bit like being on a Ferrero Rocher advert or something. He is Akbar Ahmed. He is a world-renowned expert on Islam and a former Pakistani High Commissioner to Britain. And he's just published a book based on years of research about Europe's Muslims. And we had a really great chat with him about what he found. So good, in fact, that we're going to release a full conversation as a bonus episode later this week. So look out for that.
Ooh, if you're lucky. I'm still confused as to whether we're meant to call him Ambassador Ahmed or Professor Ahmed, because he's both.
Yeah, we were just very reverential.
We were. Yeah, you enjoyed that. You like a good hierarchy, don't you, Katie?
I do. I'm extremely authoritarian in nature. That's why I love living on this populist continent. Anyway, should we get on with it?
Yeah, talking of populists, good week, bad week.
Good week, bad week.
So it's been a good week for the Italian populists following last week's bad week when they handed back the mandate to form a government due to a disagreement with the President of the Republic over a controversial finance minister. The Italian populists got it together this week and they managed to form a government with cabinet nominations, all of which were accepted by President Mattarella. This means that Giuseppe Conte is now leader of Western Europe's first populist government. Yay.
Is that true, though? I read a piece that was arguing that one of Berlusconi's governments back in the 90s could have been described as right-wing populist. But sorry, maybe we shouldn't get into that.
No, that's interesting. Yeah. Maybe the first, Western Europe's first populist government in the current form that nationalist populism is appearing.
Although that's also very nebulous. Sorry, I'm going to stop undermining you now. Carry on.
Do you want to carry on? Giuseppe Conte, the new prime minister, has a coalition of that's made up of the far-right populists, the League, and the more left-leaning populists of the Five Star Movement, although how left-leaning they are is yet to be seen. Mm. We're not in the predictions game with Italy, and I shouldn't guess what's going to happen because nobody has a clue. But there is certainly some weirdness with these two parties trying to rule together. And for example, they are going to have some difficulty coming to agreements around laws to do with civil liberties because the League are quite extreme on that. And it also seems difficult to see how they're going to deliver both the League's central promise of lowering taxes and the Five Star Movement's flagship policy of this kind of basic citizens' income for poor people, especially when Italy already has such huge debt. But they also have areas in which they agree strongly on, with regards to immigration policy mainly, and they're both pretty Eurosceptic. But yeah, so for now, everything's rosy for those Italian populists. Congratulations, I guess.
So the head of the League and the head of Five Star are both going to be deputy PMs, is that right?
Yeah.
So is Conte going to do anything? Or is he just going to kind of sit there like having, like he's got a little angel on one shoulder and a devil on the other? Or two devils?
Yeah, who knows whether he's just going to be a like a rubber stamper.
That sounds really rude.
It does, doesn't it? Anyway, that's good week. Yay. Maybe bad week is more cheery.
Maybe, depending on your viewpoint, I guess. It's been a bad week for Mariano Rajoy, who was until this week the Prime Minister of Spain. He is gone, the first ever Spanish Prime Minister to be kicked out in a vote of no confidence.
Is that true, Katie?
What?
I think you mean in the modern era.
Ugh, the first one that anyone can remember. That's fine, isn't it? So, Rajoy's Conservative Party, the People's Party, had been embroiled in this massive corruption scandal involving bribes to government contracts and that kind of thing, properly murky stuff. And the socialist leader, Pedro Sanchez, had called a vote of confidence and he won it. And now he's Prime Minister, despite only having about a quarter of the seats in Parliament. It seems like quite a weird system to us Brits, I think. But in Spain, if you present a confidence motion and you win it, you have to govern in the place of the government that you've just kicked out. So Sanchez says the plan is that he's going to finish his parliamentary term, which is another 2 years, and then have an election as planned. But we might be heading for more early elections, and there is nothing we love more on this podcast than early elections. He's only got 84 seats at the moment out of 350, so he's really going to struggle to get any laws passed unless he makes deals with other parties. So yeah, more instability looming on the continent. But what do we know about this Pedro Sanchez then? He has never been a minister before, let alone a prime minister. He kind of came from nowhere to become socialist leader 4 years ago, and he's had a really rough few years. He lost 2 elections, but he's now bounced back in a pretty spectacular way. He's seen as pretty moderate but ambitious. He is an economist. He's a former basketball player.
And he is hot.
That's the thing. He is nicknamed Mr. Handsome, which I think is justified. But I just wanted to put it on the record that I think actually the leader of Ciudadanos, which is the centrist party, is more handsome. FYI.
You centrist, you.
Love a good centrist dad.
I was thinking about the fact that there's another handsome male world leader. Like, why is it that all these handsome men end up leading countries?
They're having a moment.
They are having a moment. But, I mean, maybe it's just that handsome men have an easier ride in life.
I'm sure that's true. You would know.
Oh, stop it.
You're welcome. Wait, who else would you put on that list then?
Trudeau.
Macron at a push?
Obama, Macron at a push, yeah.
Obama has gone, Dominic. It's been a while.
Has he? This is the Europeans, Katie. It was partly started in order to stop my addiction with American politics. And I mean, it's not worked.
We have no idea what's happening over there. As far as we're concerned, Obama is still here. Is that the end of your handsomeness? Because it's not that long.
Yeah, maybe it's not that long. No, there must be some other really handsome world leaders. Listeners, please write in with if you think there are any other more handsome. No, don't. We shouldn't play this game. Let's not objectify world leaders.
I think we should move on very swiftly to the main course of this podcast, which is our interview.
We had a wonderful chat with Ambassador Akbar Ahmed, who is currently launching the fourth in a quartet of books about Islam. This one is titled Journey into Europe, Islam, Immigration and Identity. The BBC described him as the world's leading authority on contemporary Islam, and he's been working on this book for quite a long time with a big team of researchers. We were super excited to speak to him about this very complex issue that Europe has been facing for the last millennia.
Yes, he is just super smart and thoughtful, and we hope you enjoy hearing from him. I guess my first question is this. We live in a continent where we have seen repeated terrorist attacks in the name of Islam. We have seen Muslim immigrants demonized in repeated election campaigns. And we've seen Islamophobia become a daily problem for ordinary Muslims across Europe. You've written in your book that we stand at a crossroads in terms of Islam's place in Europe. Could you start by telling us what you mean by that?
By that, I mean that we are at a point in history where we are literally at the crossroads in terms of Europe. On the one hand, you have all these terrible incidents. They're feeding into the far-right politics, far-right movements, and into far-right, very dangerous-sounding rhetoric, which echoes very often the 1930s and 40s. On the other hand, I met some very inspiring people on this journey throughout Europe. Remember, I went to East, West, North, and South. And those sages of Europe, those wonderful, wise men and women of Europe, really, really inspired me and gave me a lot of hope. So I don't want to dismiss that hope and that optimism. It exists. The problem is, I don't think Europe is listening to those voices. Europe is listening to the strident voices. Europe is absorbing the media images, which, as you say, point to all the violence and the terrorism which has happened, which is happening. The answers to that violence, the answers to that movement towards that direction, lie really in listening to the sages of Europe and those wise voices.
Presumably you found similar results when you did an in-depth study into America as well. But I was just interested to find out what the main differences were in terms of like what needs to be done.
Dominic, that's a great question. There are many things that are similar, but in some senses, they are fundamentally different. Remember, the Muslim community in America and the Muslim community in Europe come from different sources. They're different sociologically, culturally, politically. For example, the Muslims coming to America come largely in the 1960s and onwards. And they're coming in as middle class, very often as doctors, medical doctors, entrepreneurs, and quite comfortably fitting into a middle class pattern and very quickly realizing what is called the American dream. That's not happening in Europe because it takes two or three generations before the immigrants in Europe begin to make an impact, if they're making an impact. So in England, you have a mayor, in Rotterdam, you have a mayor who's a Muslim. You have a dozen members of the House of Lords in London, House of Commons. You have TV presenters and so on and so on. And you've got these great footballers who are iconic in the cultural context. But as a community, the community is still struggling because their expectations have changed over the generations that they've been here. And they came really as guest workers. They were invited here to man the factories, the buses in Britain, for example. In Germany, they came under contract as guest workers. So very different cultural backgrounds. And most of them were coming from working class backgrounds. They knew little English even, or French or whatever. And they were coming simply as a survival strategy, escaping poverty, perhaps wanting to bring their kids across and give them a better education and a better life. And they find that three generations later, when their children are being born here and growing up here, that they're not quite fully accepted. They may have a passport. They may be completely as educated in that culture as their European-blooded colleague or class fellow, but they're not fully accepted. And the result is that they are now finding themselves neither fully accepted back home. So many Turks told me when we go back to Turkey, people say, you're Germans, you're not Turks. And when we come back here, the Germans say, well, you speak German, you look German, you've absorbed German culture, but you're not really German. And that is their dilemma. They're sort of suspended between cultures.
Of course, within Europe, we have lots of different national communities that count Muslims amongst them. Turks, Bosnians, second or third generation, British Pakistanis, French Algerians, Chechens, Syrian refugees, Afghan refugees, so many different communities. For what extent did you find it useful on your travels to think of Europe's Muslims as a single community?
It is useful to talk of Europe, but Europe is not one monolithic country or culture, and similarly, the Muslims are not. For example, the North Africans coming to France are different in many ways to the South Asians coming to Britain, and they have very different backgrounds. The Turks coming to Germany were never colonized by Europe. They, in fact, were colonists themselves. They have many memories of being the Ottomans, the descendants of the Ottomans, who at one stage conquered and ruled parts of East Europe. So yes, they are not a monolith today. After 9/11 especially, they are seen as a monolith by the media. So the media will simply say, a Muslim did this, a Muslim terrorist did this, whether he's Algerian or Moroccan or Pakistani or whatever.
This is perhaps an oversimplified question, but did you find on your travels around Europe countries that were doing it right, in your view, or countries that were doing it better than others in terms of community relations?
You know, I found that countries are very serious about tackling this problem. The Germans, for example, they are waking up. Here is a problem. And in some very characteristic ways, each country is responding in the way it responds. The Germans, for example, who always responded with method, with determination, and very impressively, they're saying, all right, let's study the problem, then let's tackle it. I found that they were opening up these chairs of Islamic studies, Islamic centers, very impressive, and beginning to say, all right, how do we tackle this problem? So in Germany, for example, we talked to the immigration officer dealing with immigrants. We talked throughout Europe to chief rabbis and grand muftis and Archbishop of Canterbury's and people on the right, some very hardcore right-wing people. So we got their perspective on Muslims and immigrants and so on. So that way we were able to give concrete examples of how to deal with this problem. My last chapter, in fact, has some very solid recommendations.
Can you just give us a few examples maybe of those recommendations that you mentioned in your final chapter?
My first recommendation was for Europe to listen to its sages. My second one is to discover its own past or rediscover its past. For example, I give the time of Andalusia when Muslims and Jews and Christians for long periods, not all the time, but for long periods, were able to live together. If you want a kind of new Andalusia, you need to know about it. The spirit of that, I think, would be able to inspire Europe.
I wanted to ask quickly about the kind of hangover of colonialism in Europe and how that affects the Muslim communities living in Europe, and specifically like how the different colonial setups, perhaps like in France from Algeria, how that affects how Muslim communities are living in Europe in present day.
It affects it greatly. And here's the core difference between Britain, France, partly Germany, Europe broadly, and America, where there is no hangover from any colonial era because the Americans did not really colonize Muslim countries. They were in the Philippines, there were Muslims there, but not like colonizing India or Egypt or North Africa, many of the Muslim countries. This study was really raising the question, the big philosophic question, how do minority and majority societies live together in this age? How do you deal with the other? It's not a question of a former colonial from Algeria settling in France and having a problem. It's how the majority deals with the minority there.
Yeah.
And this can be tackled. It has been tackled in the past. And it needs to be tackled because ultimately Europe is a symbol of something. It is a symbol of modernity itself. It's a symbol of Greece and ancient civilization and the basis of much of the modern world. And we have to treasure that and not lose it.
I live in France. I'm a reporter in France. So I'm particularly interested in what you made of the role of Islam in France. You know, it comes up all the time in my job as a reporter, especially because in France, secularism is really, really important in public life. But the way that that manifests itself to me often looks like Islamophobia. It's a very sort of specific French logic that they have around it. I'll give you an example. The head of the National Student Union, she's a young Muslim woman. She wore her hijab in a recent TV interview. And the interior minister was quickly up there accusing her of setting a bad example by trying to spread her religion on TV. And it became this big thing.
Yeah, I followed that, Katie. I followed that. France is fascinating because, you know, I grew up in South Asia. So for me, I look at England as a kind of standard European country. But each country is very different and each European imperialist country is very different. Now, in France, since you're there, this was not always the case. This Islamophobia was not always inherent to how the French looked at the Muslim world. And for that, go back to Napoleon Bonaparte, the unlikely example, who lands up in Cairo. He gives a dinner for the sheikhs of Al-Azhar. Now picture this, Getty. He wears Arab robes. He invites the sheikhs of Al-Azhar. And he gives a speech in which he says the holy book, the Quran, is the greatest book of inspiration. And the holy prophet is the example for which we should all follow. That was the attitude. Now, the next time the French come and encounter the Muslims in the 1830s and 40s, it's very different. This time around, they land in Algeria, and it's a straightforward military expedition. Burn, kill, slaughter. Now, when independence comes, again, have a look at it. How does it come? It comes with a great deal of bloodshed. It wasn't given gracefully or easily. So when independence is achieved, and now the Algerians want to migrate to France as immigrants, you immediately have problems because they're coming with bad memories. The French don't have good memories of Muslims in Africa because they've been resisting, there's fighting, there's all kinds of stories of torture and terrible violent deeds on both sides and so on. How many women wear the niqab in France? We know it's not even more than a couple of hundred, but they become huge symbols and they become symbols of a battle. This young girl appears on TV with it. She suddenly becomes a threat to the Republic. And I really think that the French in this regard have to chill out and see it on a different level and say, how are we treating our own minority? Because these Muslims are French. They're not going to go back to Algeria or wherever they come from in Africa. And therefore, how do we best integrate them or incorporate them or make them feel French?
Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. I just had one final question for you, Ambassador. It seems like increasingly around Europe, we have politicians like Angela Merkel or Viktor Orban, who've been kind of lining up to stress Europe's Christian tradition, saying, you know, this is a continent built on Christian values. And for me, there's often a kind of hidden subtext in there. They're basically saying, read between the lines, they're saying Christian as opposed to Muslim. And I'm curious to hear what you think about the fact that politicians are saying that increasingly. What should we make of it?
Katie, that's a great question. And I hope that these politicians who are saying that Europe is a Christian continent will listen to my answer. They don't know their own history. Charlemagne, one of the greatest founding kings, emperors of Europe, he is projected as a Christian ruler fighting the Muslims in Andalusia. But what people don't tell you is that he had the warmest relations with the greatest Muslim ruler of his time, who was the Caliph Harun al-Rashid, who ruled from Baghdad and who ruled a mighty empire which stretched across the Middle East, across North Africa, and into Central Asia. So these are incidents in history which again and again tell us that this notion of Islam versus Christianity comes on and off and is used either by the church or by politicians or kings really to promote their own immediate political gains. And if they are still promoting this idea, the simple fact is that there are millions of Muslims and they're not going anywhere. The only alternative is, if their logic is correct, is to deport them all or put them all into concentration camps or to just throw them into the sea. And if they're not going to do that, then they are stuck with them and they have to deal with them. It's as simple as that.
That was Akbar Ahmed. His book is called Journey into Europe. It is out now. It is fascinating. And as mentioned, we are going to be releasing an extended version of that conversation this week. Akbar had plenty more to say than we had room for here. And I really think it's worth your time.
And also worth your time is continuing listening for my happy ending, because it's one I'm particularly proud of this week.
Go on then.
Okay, it's a bit unusual because it's kind of essentially a public service announcement, but it could also be looked at as good news because I am about to tell you how the Macarena could save your life.
Okay.
I am indeed talking about the endlessly irritating Spanish dance hit from the 1990s that plagued our school discos as a child. Do you think they still play it in school discos, actually?
I don't know, but I did recently go to the wedding of a Spanish friend getting married to an English friend. The DJ was English and was basically playing every Spanish song he could think of. I think he played the Macarena about four times. He stopped just short of Feliz Navidad.
I love Feliz Navidad.
So good.
Anyway... back to the Macarena. So a group of scientists from the University of Barcelona, Hospital Clinic Barcelona and Universitat Autónoma Barcelona, I've also got a terrible Spanish accent, they did an experiment whereby they asked people to hum the Macarena whilst they were administering CPR. And they found out that these people were much more successful at providing the speed at which CPR pulsation can save lives, which is between 100 and 120 beats per minute.
No way!
Yeah, so they had a control group of people who didn't hum the Macarena, and they were crap and didn't save any lives of this dummy. They weren't actually doing it on real humans, I'd like to clarify.
I was going to say, that would be a more interesting experiment.
Yeah, no. But the reason why this worked is because the Macarena has a tempo of 103 beats per minute. They also had a group who used a metronome app on their phone set to 103 beats per minute. Obviously, the app is like more reliable than someone's memory of how fast the Macarena is. But they found that this app had flaws because people have to get out their phones and find the app and set it to 103 beats per minute. So they thought actually their conclusions were that humming the Macarena is like the best way to find the correct speed for giving CPR. I was a bit skeptical of this because I feel like people misremember rhythms of songs or speeds of songs very easily. So I thought we'd have a little experiment of our own. And I was wondering if you, Katie, could hum or sing a little rendition of the song. And I'm going to get out my metronome app to test whether you are right or wrong. Okay. So.
Oh, my God. The first scientific experiment on the Europeans. This is a great day.
Okay. You go.
Hey, Macarena. How's that?
Okay. It was a bit fast, so this is the actual speed. So that's 103, and you were about... You were about 117, which is within the acceptable speed. So it's between 100 and 120. So actually that worked. That was pretty good.
So I'm not going to kill someone. Yay!
No, you would have saved someone's life. And actually, genuinely, if you had to do this, you would now think of this, I think.
Do you really think in the heat of the moment, you'd be thinking, oh my God, I'm just humming the Macarena. This is so inappropriate.
Imagine someone needs their life saving and you're just like... Everyone be like, why the fuck is this crazy lady humming the Macarena while trying to give this person CPR?
Shut up, I do things my own way.
I've also, so if you don't want to hum the Macarena, if you hate it, there are other Europop hits that also fit within this speed bracket. So ABBA's Dancing Queen and S Club Party. Ain't no party like an S Club Party.
Love it.
And also the Siciliano from Bach's Second Flute Sonata.
Less Europop.
Yeah, you know the one.
No, how's it go?
You know, the one that's like, bum, dum, dum. No, I don't know it. I'm kidding. But it is apparently at the right speed.
I always thought it was supposed to be Staying Alive by the Bee Gees, which also has the appropriate message.
Oh, maybe it is. Maybe Staying Alive is right, but...
it's a little bit slower, I think. Duh, duh, duh. Staying alive.
Yeah, staying alive is right. It is exactly. You're absolutely right, Katie. I should have included that in the list.
I'm going to be saving lives all over the shop.
But the Bee Gees are American. Oh, English.
Are they? What are their names? Like Kevin Bee Gee, John Bee Gee.
Barry Gibb.
Barry, Robin, and Morris.
They're from England.
Yay!
Isle of Man.
Isle of Man.
Oh, the family moved to Australia.
Yeah, but they're still... We can claim them as our own.
Yeah, we definitely can.
Europe is so good as a continent at producing life-saving music.
Next week, we'll be back and we will maybe even be back, both of us, in our hometowns, finally.
Yay.
Actually, no, I won't. That's a lie. I'm only in my hometown for like 12 hours.
Oh, Dominic. You just need to do your laundry.
I don't have time, babe. I'll have to... Just smell.
Just walking around naked everywhere. Next week, we'll be back probably to bring you news of a couple more changes in government, because who even knows what is going on this continent anymore? We might genuinely have one in Slovenia, my new adopted homeland. So stay tuned. As always, you can find us between episodes on the interweb. We are on Twitter. We are on Instagram. We are on Facebook. Just type in the Europeans podcast. You'll find us. I think we should stop patronizing people with all the names of things.
It's a good idea. But do check out the Instagram, because Katie took some, like, as she said, really, really very smug photos from Slovenia. And I actually think her delay in Warsaw was punishment from a higher god.
Were you getting really pissed off in your rehearsal room, just scrolling down?
Yeah, I was like... Yeah, I'm also in a European city that I don't live in, but I don't have anything to take photos of because I'm in a black windowless room.
Sad.
Sad face. Anyway, have a great week, everyone, and please leave us a review on iTunes/Apple Podcasts. Okay, bye.
Adios.
How do you say it in Slovenian?
Good question. One sec.
Nasvidenje.
Zdravo.